From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Talk of the Nation. When Greg and Tierney Fairchild went in for a routine sonogram before the birth of their first child, they got some terrible news. The baby would be born with a heart defect and Down syndrome.
Well, when we first found out, we had the general stages people go through when they find out about things that they didn't expect, things that scare them. We were afraid. We went through denial. We went through depression. We went through all of the stages.
Though abortion was an option, the Fairchilds went ahead with the pregnancy and a baby girl was born. The story of her difficult birth has now been told in a new book, Choosing Naya. It's the talk of the nation after this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The head of the Senate Republican Campaign Committee went to the U.S. Supreme Court today to request that it block yesterday's ruling by New Jersey Supreme Court. That ruling allows New Jersey Democrats to replace the name of Senator Robert Torricelli with that of former Senator Frank Lautenberg on the November ballot. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Frist, who chairs the GOP Senate Campaign Committee, hand-delivered his party's request to the Supreme Court. He called the New Jersey High Court ruling unconstitutional. Frist said the laws of New Jersey clearly state that no changes can be made on the ballot within 51 days of the election, and that Republicans intend to show
that we have gone within the 51 days and that what they have done is clearly illegal and that the state Supreme Court in New Jersey does not have the authority to overturn that.
It's not clear whether the Supreme Court will even hear the case, though Republicans hope to have a response from the court in the next 2 days. Frist says for his party, Frank Lautenberg is not the legitimate Democratic candidate to run against GOP hopeful Doug Forster. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Police in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. are searching for a white cargo van, which they say could be linked to 5 random killings over the past 18 hours. Police say the 5 victims don't appear to be linked in any way. All were killed in public places. A man has been taken into custody in New York City after allegedly firing a gun into the air outside the United Nations. There are no reports of injuries. Hurricane Lily is blowing through Louisiana this hour, felling tree limbs, downing power lines, and dumping heavy rain. Lily has been downgraded to a Category 1 hurricane, but NPR's John Burnett tells us it's still a force to be reckoned with.
From where I'm standing on the porch of the Red Rose Bar in Lake Arthur, Louisiana, we can see these gusts are driving the rain horizontally. It's like a gale at sea. You can see these enormous old live oak trees throughout the town. You can see the fresh breaks on them, the white wood where these enormous limbs have come down. The streets are littered with branches. There are some power lines down and very few folks on the highway because of the seriousness of it.
NPR's John Burnett speaking to us from Lake Arthur, Louisiana, as Hurricane Lily passes through. Hurricane winds are extending 60 miles from the eye of the storm, and tornado warnings are also in effect. President Bush has declared all of Louisiana a federal disaster area. The Senate's preparing to debate a resolution giving President Bush authority to launch a strike on Iraq. Congressional leaders predict he will get the authority he is seeking by next week. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 10 points at this hour in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is down 13. The S&P is down about 5. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Martha Stewart has resigned from the board of the New York Stock Exchange. Stewart is under investigation for selling nearly 4,000 shares of ImClone Systems stock last December, a day before the biotech company disclosed some damaging news. Stewart has served for only 4 months on the exchange's board. The Illinois Supreme Court will hear an appeal from State Farm Insurance. The company is appealing the $1.2 billion decision in a 1999 class action lawsuit. Lisa Labas from Chicago Public Radio reports.
State Farm was found guilty of letting companies use substandard replacement parts to fix crashed cars and trucks. The lawsuit contended the parts were inferior and did not deliver the same level of quality, fit, and safety as factory-made parts. The decision at the time was the largest award ever against an insurance company. And after the verdict, State Farm stopped using replacement parts. Several other insurance companies followed suit. State Farm officials say the company hopes the high court will address what it views as serious flaws in the trial court's judgment. Meantime, an attorney for the plaintiff says the appeal will be an opportunity for the court to show and support the strength of the Consumer Fraud Act. The state high court said it expects to hear the appeal in the spring. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labas in Chicago.
The dock workers' dispute in the West has forced one of the San Francisco Bay Area's major employers to shut down its truck and auto production lines. The new United Motor Manufacturing plant in Fremont is a joint venture between Toyota and General Motors. It employs 5,100 workers and depends heavily on imported engines and transmissions. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations, the Annenberg Foundation, and Rockefeller Brothers Fund, on the web at rbf.org.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in for Neil Conan. What would you do if you discovered your child would be born with a severe disability? That was the agonizing question facing Greg and Tierney Fairchild when they learned, 21 weeks into Tierney's first pregnancy, that their unborn child had a major heart defect and Down syndrome. The couple had only a few weeks to take in this news, cope with their emotions, talk with their families and friends, meet with medical experts, and decide what to do. The story of Greg and Tierney Fairchild's final decision and its consequences are chronicled in a new book called Choosing Naya, A Family's Journey. With us is the author of the book, Mitchell Zukoff. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe. He joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Lynn.
And also joining us are the parents of Naya, Greg and Tierney Fairchild. They're joining us from the studios of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Thanks so much for being with us, both of you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Hello, Lynn.
And we invite you, of course, the audience, to call in. Have you had to make a similar decision? Do you know someone who did? What challenges did you face? Did you or a family member, do you know a family member with Down syndrome? And if you work in the medical field, nurses, doctors, genetic counselors, we want to hear from you too. What information do you give to expecting parents? How do you help them cope with difficult news? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Mitch Zukoff, let's start with you. First of all, how did you get involved with this story? And did it start out as one story and then become another?
Well, Lynn, I had been following along, like many of us, as the human genome. We were racing to map the human genome, and we were hearing more and more about prenatal testing and all that we could do. And it occurred to me that we weren't paying all that much attention as reporters to the human side of the equation. What happens when you get this news? How do you process it? What helps and what hurts? And so I decided the best way to tell that story was to find a family who was living through it and see what happened. And as you said, see what the consequences are of these decisions.
But you seem to be with the Fairchilds through everything. I mean, how did that come about?
Well, I had been searching for the right family for a number of months, and I posted a memo describing what I was looking for on a listserv of genetic counselors. And one happened to be the genetic counselor who Tierney and Greg were working with. They gave it to Tierney and Greg. I got a call from Tierney one day in August of 1998, and they had just been through the decision. So I was able to go back in time with them a few weeks to find out from the moment they found that the child they were going to have was not going to be the one they expected, and then follow from there.
So you were not actually there at the moment that that they found out during this sonogram?
No. I think it would have been impossible from a privacy standpoint to be just hanging around sonogram rooms waiting for something to go wrong.
Yeah. Why did you want to tell this story? I mean, I know you mentioned that you were looking at the personal side, but what are some of the issues that you were trying to get at by telling this story, this human story?
Well, I think, you know, we've got this tremendous scientific knowledge, and we've got this legal right to choice. And where do those two intersect? And how does it intersect in somebody's home, sitting around a dinner table, talking about where it hits home? And I thought that as a newspaper, the Globe was in a position to really let the story unfold and bring readers into those pieces of information.
This is such a personal story. You had to have gotten somewhat involved in it. How did you manage to, or did you, maintain your journalistic objectivity as you were reporting this story?
Well, I gained a tremendous amount of affection for Tierney and Greg and ultimately for Naya. But I was able to, if not completely objective, certainly impartial, that I had to follow the story where it led. We knew that this story could end tragically. And in a number of times throughout the 4 years I've been working with them, they approached tragedy several times. Unfortunately, it didn't go there. But I just had to maintain enough of a distance to be true to the story.
Did you ever have a moment where you thought of backing off? Where it crossed your mind, maybe I shouldn't be here for this?
The only time was when actually Tierney and Greg expressed a concern about that. 4 months into Naya's life, she had to undergo open-heart surgery. And one thing that Tierney and Greg felt very strongly about was they didn't want anyone recording her death. And so when the incision was made, I and the Globe photographer, Suzanne Kreider, stepped out of the room at that point.
Greg and Tierney Fairchild, let me bring you into this conversation. First of all, let me ask you, this is extraordinary that you were this open with a reporter. Let me ask you, before I even get into all the details of your story, what made you want to tell your story like this, Greg?
Well, one of the things I realized as we went through our process was that early on we had this need to find out as much information as we possibly could. And we thought that sharing that story would be a way that we could tell other people about the types of questions that people might ask, the types of things they might worry, the resources that might be out there that they could seek and find that helped us make our decision. I think one of the other parts is that so often in our pregnancy, we had talked about, but only very briefly, the possibility that we might have a child that wouldn't be this perfect child that we'd thought about, a child that would be the most popular child in school, the best athlete, the brightest child, above average in every way.
Mm-hmm. And which is what everybody thinks, right?
Which is what everybody thinks. Mm-hmm. And since we hadn't really reflected on that in any deep and thoughtful way, mm-hmm. we thought sharing our story might encourage others to think about that a little bit more.
Greg, an interesting story from your perspective. You both learned of the problems your baby would have during a routine sonogram. That was the first hint. And Greg, you were looking at the picture and you had an idea just by looking at the picture before anyone had said anything to you that something might be wrong, didn't you?
I did. I remembered from high school biology that mammals have 4 chambers in their heart. And I did have a notion that something might be wrong, Lynn, but I wasn't really sure. Ultrasounds are amazing technology. The thought that this technology could look inside of a heart of a very small child, and see literally the septums that separate that heart into the 4 chambers was something that I was amazed by to start with. Now, when I noticed that there were only 3 visible chambers, I worried about it, but my basic assumption was, well, the technology is really good, but it's not that good.
Hmm. Tierney, what about you? When did you really understand that something was wrong?
Well, I guess actually it was when the sonologist went out of told us that she was having a little trouble and she needed to get to finding the heart and to getting a good look at it, and she needed to bring someone else in. I actually had a tiny hint then, although afterwards I realized she just did a wonderful job of kind of keeping me very calm, and it was when the doctor came in, he was a high-risk OB, and he then told us that indeed he was having trouble, and we needed to go into another room where he could see more closely to go to a better machine. And as soon as he said that, I was very aware that something was awry and concerned that really for my baby.
Now, remind me, Tierney, when did you begin to realize just how serious the problem? When did you find out, and how did you find out just how serious the problems were?
Well, what happened was that as soon as the doctor came in and he first shared the news that indeed there were only three chambers that were visible, that the defect that he was seeing, and heart defects actually happen in about 101 in 125 births or so. So he's used to seeing a heart defect, but this particular one where there were two holes in the heart was highly correlated with Down syndrome. And he suggested to us that if we wanted to understand that we would need to have an amniocentesis to know that information.
And so you first, did that.
Yeah, we did that. We did that right then and there. So we went from actually having packed our bags to go on a vacation to Martha's Vineyard that afternoon to think that we were going into a routine sonogram and getting ready to get off on the road so we could make our ferry, to having someone, you know, tell you that your child has a heart defect and may have Down syndrome.
Mm. When you did finally get the news that that in fact your child would have a heart defect and would have Down syndrome, did you really understand the implications right away? Did you think right away, we can go ahead with this pregnancy or we can terminate it? Was that even in your head? I mean,
well, I think one of the great things was on the very night that we first had the ultrasound where they found this heart defect, we were actually connected at that point with Alicia Craffey. She was our genetic counselor. She called us that evening, and we began talking with her about our questions involving the heart and the medical conditions that might result from the heart defect, and questions involving Down syndrome. And that very evening, she left for us some reading material about Down syndrome. And we didn't find out officially, that is, the results of the amniocentesis until ten days later. But we had, during that 10-day period, been reading about heart defects and Down syndrome, and she'd been referring us to people to talk to. So we were relatively informed by the time we actually found out the confirmed diagnosis.
Now, I know one thing that was hard right at the beginning was you were getting some conflicting advice and reactions within your family, Tierney, you in particular, right?
Yeah. I think what happens with families is that when you get information like this, their first instinct is to try to be supportive. And my family tried to do just that, but often, in doing so, there's a lot of fear that kind of comes out. And so you're dealing with both your own fears, but also the fears that your family is having for you and the concerns that they're having. And while we were getting a lot of information to bring ourselves up to speed, they weren't getting that kind of information themselves, not in all cases. So there, you know, you're kind of operating from pulling out from your past experience. When was the last person with Down syndrome that you had seen? What was your reaction to that person? Did you know anyone that had a heart defect, and was it ever repaired? So all of those kinds of things came into play, and they were difficult for us to manage at the same time that we were managing our own emotions on this very difficult decision.
I think it's also important to think that for a family member who has someone who gets this type of diagnosis, or really any type of threatening medical information, it's an all-hands-on-deck situation. People rush to your side, and they support as best they can. They may not know and have up-to-date information, but they're providing the best information and support they can, given the context and the time period.
Was there one piece of information, one conversation? I mean, what was it that finally made you decide we're going to continue with this pregnancy?
I would say, Lynn, that we really concluded on a very, a data information gathering process. We had been talking with doctors, our counselor, even other families who had children with Down syndrome, who had the heart defect, who were the firstborn in the family. And all of that with the help of our genetic counselor. It wasn't until we had been going back and forth on this issue, and our faith came into play as well. And we asked ourselves the question of, you know, why not us? Why can't we handle this if other people can? And that information came from a very interesting conversation that Greg had with a woman who runs an adoption agency for children specifically that have Down syndrome. And it was after that conversation with the person that he spoke with who essentially told us that she could place any child with Down syndrome, who had a heart defect, who was biracial, who we wouldn't maybe have put up for adoption for a while, that we said, wait, this is all the information I think we need. We really can handle this together.
Well, Naya was born on November 22nd, 1998. We're going to hear more about her birth and her first year of life and all that you've faced since when we continue. We're talking with Greg and Tierney Fairchild about their decision to give birth to their daughter Naya after prenatal testing showed that she would be born with Down syndrome. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, in for Neil Conan. We're talking with Mitch Zukoff, author of Choosing Naya, A Family's Journey, and the family he writes about, Greg and Tierney Fairchild. The Fairchilds learned through prenatal testing that their daughter would be born with Down syndrome. They decided to go ahead with the birth. Their daughter, Naya, is now 3.5 years old. We want to hear about your experiences as well. Have you or a member of your family faced a similar decision? If you've worked in the health field, how do you tell expectant parents they're developing child will be born with disabilities? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to get into some details of the birth of Naya and the beginning of her life. But first, I want to turn again to Mitch Zukoff, because you first wrote about this story in a 6-part series in the Boston Globe. And I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of the kind of reaction that you got.
We got a wonderful, enormous reaction, Lynn. People were, I think, very touched by it because it was a very personal story. Overwhelmingly, it was a positive reaction. We got literally several thousand letters, emails, phone calls, people doing what you're doing here today, offering their own stories, their experiences with the medical community, things that helped, things that hurt, information that was false that was passed on to them, and it was quite gratifying.
Did you get some critical responses at all?
We did. There were some people who said flat out, Naya should not have been born. This is a burden on society. But they were outweighed 95-98 to 1. But certainly there were some people out there who felt that way and expressed it.
Well, let's see how some of the people in our audience are responding. Joy in West Bend, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you for this program. It is an important subject. I just wanted to relate that I happen to be a nurse midwife. I haven't practiced for many years, but I was a nurse midwife before I became a mother with a daughter with Down syndrome. And I, in having your program today, it's kind of helped me gel a little thought I had about my own psychology, and that I haven't gone back to practice as a nurse midwife since having our daughter. I have worked part-time as a nurse, but I just think that one of the things that keeps me from going back to practice is the fact that I would be expected to counsel people on, you know, you're of an age where you need to have genetic testing and you need to consider whether you would choose to keep your pregnancy or terminate your pregnancy if you have a child with a defect. I just consider our daughter a perfect individual and have been enriched by her life, although by no means this is a piece of cake. I just think that people need to consider personal stories like this, and that, I'm just having a hard time speaking because I feel so emotional. I just don't think that I would be able to go back to work as a nurse midwife and objectively talk to people about their choices, although I believe in a woman's right to choose or a family's right to choose to keep or terminate a pregnancy. It's just horrible for me to think of somebody choosing to stop a pregnancy because that child has a defect.
Joy, if I can jump in, it's Mitch Zuckoff. 9 out of 10 pregnancies that where Down syndrome is found end in abortion. I almost wonder if somebody with your perspective might be valuable, especially valuable, going back to work, because you can provide, if not completely balanced information, at least, you know, a fuller perspective than some people are getting right now.
Yes, I think that I would be trying to talk people into keeping their child.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that our culture as a whole has such a bias against somebody who might have a little less ability cognitively, and that's too bad. It's too bad that we all have to be concerned about competition and worried about someone taking advantage of someone who has less cognitive ability. It would just be a richer, much richer world if we all saw it through the eyes of a person with Down syndrome.
Well, thank you for your call, Joy.
Joy?
Yeah.
This is Greg. What's your daughter's name?
Inga.
Inga. You know, I know for us, we found that as you find out more and more information about the cognitive abilities of children with Down syndrome, and I'm sure you found this.
Right.
There's a moving target. When I grew up, what I knew about Down syndrome was really via some short experiences I had with Special Olympics. And I really didn't realize the breadth and depth and possibilities for people with Down syndrome because I really wasn't involved in the movement in a personal way. After having my daughter, I find that certainly there are challenges that she has developmentally. But I'd say that most people would be surprised at the things that people with Down syndrome can do.
Yes, that was true for us. We, as a nurse, I can remember reading a pamphlet that somebody with Down syndrome is moderately to severely cognitively disabled, and now, you know, if you read a textbook, it would say more like mildly to moderately, and the implications of what that means, yes, there's a wide range, and our daughter certainly functions on a fairly high level. We have not had her IQ tested because we don't want her to be limited, and, you know, by now, with all of our work on advocacy, we have a pretty good school program for her and an inclusion program, so... but it has taken a lot of work for us to be learning how to be good advocates, and it has taken a lot of group effort with other people that we know with children with disabilities to get our whole community more on board.
I wanted to ask you, Greg, thanks so much for your call, Joy, and thanks for your perspective. Joy raised the question of discrimination, and I know both Greg and Tierney, discrimination was something you worried about because you worried that your daughter was going to be discriminated against on two counts, that she has a disability and also that she is from a biracial marriage and that she's a biracial child. And that went into you thought about that beforehand as well, didn't you?
I did. I growing up, I had been aware of discrimination on numbers of levels. You know, as a person that's black, I certainly had experienced it. My parents had experienced it, but I'd even been around people with developmental delays, and I knew that they were discriminated against as well. I think we finally came to a decision similar to the decision we made when we decided to have a child, that we were prepared. We were prepared to handle discrimination. I think in hope that in certain ways we might be able to change people's opinions, people's knowledge, and that through that discrimination might be diminished. But we certainly knew it would happen, and in a certain way we're disappointed to think that there would be a new type of discrimination that neither of us had known about before.
All right, let's take another call. John in San Jose, California. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Did you say John from San Jose?
Yes.
I'm having trouble hearing. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I don't think this is going to work. Bye.
Okay. Sorry about that. Let me just go to another call then. Mike in California. Hello, Mike.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. A couple quick questions. With the genetic and the DNA testing before conception, if they were diagnosed that the child would have had Down syndrome, would they opt for pregnancy at that point?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
They can diagnose before pregnancy that your child will probably have a defect.
This is Greg. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, it's one of the great things I think about getting the story out is that Down syndrome actually occurs at conception. Down syndrome occurs when the sperm and egg come together, and in 99% of cases would not be able to be determined prior to conception. Now, maybe the caller is talking about some other types of genetic problems that people might have that could be. But with Down syndrome, there are some certain specific, very unusual types of Down syndrome that might be able to be captured through genetic testing. And in fact, we had genetic testing and don't carry any of those markers that would have predicted having a child with Down syndrome.
I'd like to move now also to Naya's birth. Tierney, right before the birth, some problems started developing. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Lynn, we had been closely monitored for the rest of our pregnancy after we had learned and started moving on with the pregnancy. And so I had actually been going and having routine ultrasounds almost on a, you know, every other week. And I was gotten to the point where we had scheduled a cesarean section for early December. And we had just come off of having an ultrasound where everything looked great. And on that weekend, my sister was visiting. We were out having lunch. And I was just noticing that the baby really wasn't kicking as often. And I let it go for a little while. We got back from lunch and sort of had, you know, kind of relaxed. And I said, you know, maybe I'm just not focusing on it. And eventually I called Greg in. I said, Greg, I'm really concerned. And I called the baby line that I had through my insurance company, Cigna, that came about that the nurse there said, well, you should probably call your doctor given your situation. I said, okay. Called my doctor and he said, why don't you just have something to eat, make sure it's not that the baby's sleeping, because when the baby gets very large, a lot of times there's less room to move and they can sleep very much more. So he said, let's see if we can wake the baby up. I'll call you back in 45 minutes. Well, 20 minutes later, he calls back, what did you feel? And I said, I'm not feeling much. And he said, well, let's go in, come on in. I happen to be on call. When we got into the hospital, actually, at this point, we sort of thought it was pretty routine that they were just going to listen to the heartbeat, make sure everything was okay, and we were going to go home. And it really didn't occur to us until he started doing some testing on the ultrasound and started having the people that were with him, I believe the residents, calling out numbers like 2 and 0, which I assumed were on a scale of 10, that we really realized that things were awry. We delivered Naya via an emergency C-section, and she stayed in the NICU for, that's the neo-intensive mm-hmm. care unit, for almost 10 days, struggling with her life.
Yeah, and then she needed heart surgery. She needed to gain enough weight in order to get that heart surgery. I mean, there were a lot of difficulties just immediately.
Absolutely. We had actually expected, because we had known ahead of time about the diagnosis, one of the wonderful things about knowing ahead of time is that we were very prepared for everything. And so we expected that Naya was going to have those challenges, but first we had to get her home from the hospital, which wasn't expected. And once we did, it was a real focus on getting her weight up to 8 pounds so that she could have the surgery.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News. During that first year when you had so many difficulties and seeing your daughter undergo this very difficult surgery, I was looking at a picture of her today, just wires coming out of her body everywhere. Did either of you ever second-guess yourself? Did you ever wonder, did we do the right thing here?
I did. Tierney and I had different fears about different things. I had some experience, as I said earlier, with Down syndrome, and had a cousin that was adopted who was mentally retarded. But I had no experience with heart defects, and I'm not a fan of open heart surgery. And so, for me, many of the experiences we had both in the NICU and then later on when she was having her open heart surgery were really the parts that were for me the most scary. I did wonder, particularly at the point of heart surgery, if she had not made it, whether people who knew our story, family members and friends, would say that this had been a mistake if she didn't clear the surgery.
What about you, Tierney?
I think Greg is right in saying that we did have different fears. As soon as Naya was born and I actually made it through that hurdle, which was, you know, she almost lost her life in that, I had decided that we were going to do everything we possibly could to ensure that she was going to get what she needed. And I did have less concerns medically. I mean, we were going to doctor's visits at one, you know, few weeks, we were almost going every day. And while it was tiring, I think that I knew that we were going to pull through. Just something in my gut was saying, just keep working this. You know, we are very faithful people. And, you know, there was one very important sermon that we heard in church when we were making our decision, where the priest said, the miracle you ask for may not be the miracle you receive. And so I knew that this miracle that was my daughter was somebody that needed to have life. And so I was very hopeful. I was more concerned, I would have to say, about the Down syndrome and what I didn't know. And just like the last caller said, you know, or Joyce said, it is very difficult to deal with a society where, you know, people do not always value those that aren't as cognitively capable. And so I feared more on the social side and how we were going to be able to get her integrated with, you know, normal life, so to speak.
Let's see if we could take a call before we go for a short break. Lydia in St. Louis. Hello, Lydia.
Hello, this is Lydia Orso.
Go ahead.
Yes, I personally have Down syndrome. And I would like to say that I have a boyfriend who has Down syndrome, and I've gone through speech, occupational, and physical therapy. And I was wondering if I could ask the parents, has their daughter been to any of those therapies?
Tierney?
Well, Lydia, it's first of all great to hear from you, and I hope you and your boyfriend are having a good time. Indeed, we did. We actually put Naya in her therapies in the 2 weeks after she came home from the hospital. She started with her therapy, which was availed to her through early intervention, and she has had speech, occupational, and physical therapy routinely for the last 3.5 years. So we are very committed, and it sounds like, you know, you've benefited greatly. We are very committed to ensuring that Naya has that start that hopefully she can achieve like you have.
Mm-hmm. I also have friends that have Down syndrome. And not only that, but I work at the Down Syndrome Association. And we help people with Down syndrome out in the community. And I just want to let you know that's where I work.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Lydia, because it's a great perspective to have and for people to hear how clearly you're speaking. And, you know, we were saying before, people have prejudices sometimes against people with Down syndrome, and congratulations on doing so well. Thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
We're going to continue our discussion with Mitch Zukov and Greg and Tierney Fairchild. After a short break, I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, AARP, with services, advocacy, and information for making the most of life after 50, www.aarp.org, Jennifer and Ted Stanley, and Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, educating Americans on the issues of affordable electricity from coal and a cleaner environment. BalancedEnergy.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
God and country. What do you do when allegiance to one conflicts with allegiance to the other? I'm Lynn Neary. Some Christian leaders are challenging the notion of a military conflict with Iraq. How do your religious beliefs shape your view on war? That's the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. On the next Science Friday, Ira Flatow talks with Dean Ornish and experts from the Atkin Center and the National Academy of Sciences about how to succeed at losing weight. Today, we're talking about one family's decision to give birth to a baby they learned would be born with Down syndrome. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK or email us at totn@npr.org. Our guests are Mitchell Zukov, author of Choosing Naya, A Family's Journey. He's also a reporter with the Boston Globe. And Greg and Tierney Fairchild, the parents of Naya, who was born with a severe heart defect and Down syndrome. Let's go right to the callers now because we have a lot of people waiting now. Anne in St. Louis. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. This is Anne, and I'm an OBGYN, and I'm also a geneticist, so I see families like those you've been talking with today. And I just called because I think the nurse midwife, I think her name was Joy, who called, has really done a very wise thing by sort of, you know, taking herself out of the environment. And I say that because as a geneticist, we practice medicine in a little different way in that the way we discuss options with family is called non-directiveness. And it's very different from the rest of medicine where, you know, you have a problem, you go see a physician, and they tell you what they think you should do for the problem. It's very different in genetics because, of course, we don't walk in our patient's shoes, and we don't come to the situation that the family find themselves in with their background. I think some physicians who may have had bad experiences with individuals with disabilities may color the way they speak to families, and I think you've heard some experiences like that. similarly, I think families who've had really good experiences may tend to color things the other way. And unfortunately, we all have to walk through the walk through the world having our own experiences, and no one can say whether you're which side of the fence your experience is going to fall on.
Well, I think that's a good point. And Greg and Tierney, I imagine, would you have wanted somebody pushing you in one direction or the other, do you think, as you were making this decision?
I think it's important to note that our genetic counselor, likely trained very similar to the last caller, never pushed in any way. I think what she did was she provided us with numbers of perspectives from numbers of people. Now, one of the things that is a reality is that we asked, for instance, as Tierney said earlier, to talk to families who had children with Down syndrome. Obviously, most of these families were people who had not been in a choice position. But one of the problems is the silence of families who choose not to go forward. So we weren't given an opportunity to talk to people who might have chosen the other side. And I think the caller is right in that what's really important is to give people the notion that there's information out there, and they can make a decision based on the information that's available and consulting with friends, family, clergy, all of those things.
Thanks very much for your call, Anne. And, I have an email here that sort of gets to this this question as well. It's from Aveen who says, my child may have Down syndrome, may be with Down syndrome. And the question is it okay to think I can't handle it? Tierney?
Well, that's a tough question. I can imagine that Aveen is going through a very difficult time, and I think that we all have to give ourselves a break in these situations. At any one point in our journey toward this decision, at one point I didn't think I could handle it. At another point, Greg didn't think he could handle it. I think that if you have a partner that you're sharing this with, it's important to keep those communications open so that when the information that you're getting, you can hear it and you can have people to talk it over with. But ultimately, you do have to be able to say, what can I handle? And, need to, I just think it's important not to make an excuse for yourself, but yet to be able to understand and work on what you are able to do.
Yeah, I think Tierney said this, and I'd second it. If this caller has a spouse, it's important that they both get all of their questions answered and their doubts. And I think it's also unlikely to assume or not accurate to assume that people who might choose not to go forward wouldn't also have some questions and doubts about that decision.
Okay.
Yeah, the important thing, I think, as well is I think the point, one of the key points of the book is about informed choice. If she's making her decisions based on the best available information, not based on, I'm not saying she is, but about old wives' tales, stories from 30 years ago or 50 years ago about what it was like to have a child with Down syndrome then she'll be in the best position to make the right choice for herself.
All right. Let's take another call. Pat in Altadena, California. Hello, Pat, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It was great to hear from Lydia, to know that, she's out there, she's working, and she's doing really well. And when we got our prenatal diagnosis, I have a 7-year-old son with Down syndrome, that's who I needed to hear from. That's what I needed to know. And at the time, we weren't on the Internet. It was a Friday when we got the diagnosis. We went all weekend without information. And I call it my black days. It was so, so very, very hard. Little by little, we got started getting some information and meeting other families, and I think that's the critical piece. But until then, I think the hardest part about a prenatal diagnosis is you don't have your baby in your arms to reassure you that, oh, this is just a baby. It's just a baby, and he's cute as can be, and he does what other babies do. And that was, one of our really big fears at first. So when people talk about a choice and getting information from geneticists and doctors, my worry is that kind of information about the capabilities doesn't really get to the families. And certainly we're out here in Southern California. I've heard so many stories of families who geneticists talked to them and said, gave them a laundry list of, well, here's what your kid won't be able to do. And generally, that was wrong. So my concern is that people have a choice. Now, of course, we know that my son is the greatest gift we've ever been given. He's wonderful. He's doing great. And we didn't know that at the time. And that's what I would like people to know.
You know, the genetic counselor that Tierney and Greg worked with, Alicia Craffey, makes that exact point. It's a great point that when you get a prenatal diagnosis, you're told this is what's wrong with your child.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only thing you know about the child, not even sometimes if it's a boy or a girl, but that it has this problem or this syndrome or this condition. And that is something that, again, Alicia Craffey describes as a potential downside of prenatal testing.
Okay.
If I could add, you know, another thing about getting perspectives, and I think it's a limitation for many of the doctors and OBGYNs, is that their moment of time with families is during the birth period. They're not as often connected to the educators or the physical therapist or speech therapist who work with 15, 16, 17-year-old now teenagers, and then they don't work with adults. And so the wonderful thing about someone like an Alicia is that they can connect you to many people along that road at many stages, which helps you to get a very nuanced view of what you might face.
Okay, thanks so much. Let's take another call. Let's talk with Andrea in, I think it's Hawkinsville, Georgia. Are you there, Andrea?
Yes, I am. I had a question for the Fairchild. First of all, I'd like to say how much I honor and respect their choice to go through with the pregnancy. I was a veteran of the Gulf War, and I have three children, and I had three chorionic villi samplings between weeks 9 and 12. And I'm wondering, had they had this sampling done, would they have changed their decision? And also, I'd like to comment about how chorionic villi sampling is widely available in the United States, and if risk factors are determined by the caretaking doctor and ordered, insurance will pay for it.
And we should point out that that test can be done much earlier is the
yeah.
point you're making.
Before the baby's kicking and growing and you're loving on it.
Would it have changed your minds, Tierney?
Well, I don't think it would have, but, you know, I think we would have been going through the same process of data gathering and information. What I will agree with Andrea on is that you don't have the same kicking and feeling that you would have that you might have earlier. But I remember when I became pregnant, I was joyful for the pregnancy and knew that as my body was growing and changing, that was, you know, a life inside of me. So I hope that I would have the strength to make the same decision. I think we would go through the same process, and I think it's important that just because a baby might not be kicking inside you doesn't mean that you don't need to give it the same attention when you learn of some news that might be altering your expectations.
If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-TALK. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's now go to Cheryl, who is calling us from Germany. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to really say how happy I am to hear the help that they've had and the concern that they've gotten from people to help them make this decision. I also want to comment on the caller about the society today and how they aren't accepting of people with disabilities. It's a very sad situation. But I had a similar situation. I gave birth in 76 to a boy that had hydrocephalus, and I didn't find out until I was ready to give birth and my water broke, and I didn't have the support, and searched diligently to find someone to help us, and there was no one, and it was a very traumatic thing going through with being only 21, my first child. And I thought of many times of writing a book at that time to help people make decisions because I did give my child up. I didn't know what to do, didn't know my options, and I think if I would have gone through that now, I would have kept my child.
This was 1976, is that what you said?
1976, yeah. And
which, of course, at that time, there was much less known.
Much less.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I asked someone, I said, now, why doesn't anybody know about this? And it was a shocking answer. They said, well, most of the people just leave the hospital,
mm-hmm.
leave the baby behind. I was in shock when they said that, you know. So I am just so grateful that medicine has come so far, that there is help for people. and to make these decisions, because I think when you come to this realization, like Mr. Fairchild said, it was a shock. You go into a depression. You go through all these emotions. You can't make a wise decision through at this time.
Did anybody tell you what the disability was, or how the child would be affected, or?
No, I didn't know that there was a problem until he didn't fall in the birth canal, and they took an X-ray, and he had water on the brain, hydrocephalic. The head was the size of a 5-year-old. It was very advanced. He was already blind and deaf, and had only a third of his brain. And
Cheryl, I just want to say thank you for calling, and I want to turn the discussion for a moment back to Mitchell Zukov, because this illustrates the point I think he was trying to make with his series, with this book, that knowledge is everything, I think.
Yeah.
Precisely.
So I'm really grateful that there is help out there for people now, because it's very traumatic, you know, and to make a good decision, you need help.
Thanks so much
for
calling.
Thank you for calling, Cheryl.
Great,
you're welcome.
Great point. Thank you.
God bless you.
Mitchell, did you want to just comment on that, since it does so well illustrate a lot about what you were trying to do when you set off into this project?
Yeah, very much so. In the past 26 years, if we use Cheryl's experience as a baseline, we've gained so much more understanding, both of the medical and of what Tierney and Greg have described in terms of the emotional and expectations of what we can think about our lives are going to be like with children who have disabilities. And if you just, you know, just, I think, again, Cheryl illustrates it beautifully. She can look back now and say, had she known then what she knows now, she would have done things differently. And that the power of information, good, solid information gained from experts, from people who've been through it, I think allows people, because the issue is not just what decision you make, it's how you feel about the decision 26 years later. And that's what I think Tierney and Greg and their experience can illustrate for people.
Thank you all. Thank you for joining us for this discussion today. Mitchell Zukov is the author of Choosing Naya, A Family's Journey. He spoke to us from member station WBUR in Boston. Greg and Tierney Fairchild, thank you so much. And I have to mention, not only is Naya 3.5, but you have another child now, too. So congratulations. The Fairchilds joined us from the studios of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Talk of the Nation is directed by Devin Robbins. Our producers are Cece Madupe-Fadupe, Susan Lund, Setsko Sato, and Justine Kennan. Jane Lintholm is our production assistant. Our intern is Gregory Chisholm. Technical directors this week were Michael Cullen, Cal Southworth, Marty Kersius, with engineering support from Neil Tivolt, Bill Deputy, Josh Rogoshin, and Mark Greenhouse. Senior editor is Ellen Silva. Senior producer is Sue Goodwin. Leith Bishop is our executive producer. Neil Conan returns on Monday. And in Washington, I'm Lynn Neary, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the George Gund Foundation, celebrating 50 years of philanthropy in 2002. The Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future. The Ford Foundation, sponsor of the 2002 Leadership for a Changing World Awards, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Diet books always rank high on the bestseller list, touting the benefits of a low-fat or a low-carb diet. But what's the real science behind these diets? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on the next Science Friday for a discussion with Dean Ornish and experts from the Atkins Center and the National Academy of Sciences. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.